From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn, wrapping up my week in New York. On today's show, New York Times theater critic Jesse Green on how current events change the way that plays are being received. Then Nadine Lubacki, the director of Lebanon's Oscar entry Capernaum, cast non-professional actors to play the homeless children on the streets of Beirut.
Everyone is almost living, portraying their own story in life, their own struggle in life. So it's not really a documentary, but there's a documentary part to it.
And Lindsay Buckingham takes us back for a fresh listen to one of Fleetwood Mac's biggest hits.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. I have been in New York all week, seeing a lot of theater, 5 plays in 4 days. Keep listening to The Frame in the days and weeks ahead to hear interviews from some of the key creative talent involved in the shows. And just before I headed to the airport to come home, I sat down with Jesse Green. He, along with Ben Brantley, is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times. Green is as much reporter as he is reviewer, and his theater notices are thoroughly researched and deeply contextual. Like a lot of smart writers, he looks at how a play or musical is received based not only on what happens on stage, but also what's happening outside of the walls of the theater. When Green and I started talking, I asked him what he believes his role is as a critic.
I have a huge problem deciding what to call a critic's pick, which is an annoying thing just short of having to do stars, like, oh my God, 4 stars or whatever. But anyway, to answer your question, yeah, I see my job as to report on my experience of working my way through the material and to give you, whether you see the show or not, an experience that is that speaks to what the author is trying to say. Most of the people who read reviews are not going to see these shows. They can't. Maybe they're not in New York or they don't have the money, but they can still, by reading a good review, get some of the feeling of what it is and think about the issues it's trying to raise.
So when I went to see 3 plays in particular this week, Network, Lifespan of a Fact, and To Kill a Mockingbird, I was struck by one thing with every play, and that is that these stories are generally set in places other than present day. And it kept reminding me that the era in which and the time and place you see a play can really change the way that that information is received. And I thought it was especially true with Network, which in many ways, Paddy Chayefsky absolutely predicted not only the rise of reality television, but also of Fox News. I think Lifespan of a Fact, all of the comments that we've heard lately about what is truth, alternative facts, made that even more relevant. And then To Kill a Mockingbird, obviously a period story that felt, and I think this is an intention of the creative team, felt like it happened yesterday. Would you agree that toward the end of the season, these plays landed in a different way based on what's happening in the world and in our country?
Absolutely, but it has to be said, there's a bit of a confirmation bias going on. These productions were selected by their savvy producers in part because of their sense that they would speak to us now in a way that would make them sell. And I think they were right in general.
Do you think that changes your job as a critic? Do you have to evaluate these plays not only for like their execution, but also their relevance?
Well, you don't have to. You could write a really fascinating review. And I've read the reviews by many of my colleagues in the field of some of these plays that really responds to the sensation of being in the theater at that moment. And those are fun. For me, the thing that most interests me is the argument. And in order to understand the argument of a production like To Kill a Mockingbird, you really have to look into what was Harper Lee doing, what is Aaron Sorkin doing, and what is the struggle between those two things?
I went last night to the opening night party for To Kill a Mockingbird, and I talked to 2 people totally at random. One was Kenya Barris, who created the show Black-ish, and the other one was John David Washington, who is the star of Black Klansman. We started talking briefly about theater. Both of them said the play that they were most excited about was Slave Play.
I reviewed that earlier in the week, and gave it a critic's pick, and there was never a question in my mind. That was one case where I did not have to think about whether I really wanted to do that. It's an extraordinary and kind of mind-boggling new play by a first-time in New York playwright, and daring, you know, push-buttony and all of those things, but really profoundly of this moment, and with something to talk about that we need to talk about.
And that feels like that's an important part of what your job is in terms of kind of being a gatekeeper. It's like, this is something that maybe was not on your radar, and this is something that should be.
Well, and it's something that will never come to Broadway. You know,
if
Well, if I told you the first 30 seconds of plot, you would...
Which you did in your review.
Yeah, I did. I mean, let's just say it's highly sexualized. It's not shy about talking about that, but it's really about race and the way black bodies are colonized by white people. The author wants to basically ask white people, who are still the majority of theatergoers on Broadway, to like be quiet for a minute and listen to what the experience of being black in relationships is like. That's not something that would sell on Broadway, and it's not something that would be able to tell what it needs to tell on Broadway.
I want to ask you more about that idea of like representation, the stories that do and do not get told in theater, and especially on Broadway. I was talking earlier today with Lee Silverman, who directed two plays that are running right now, Lifespan of a Fact and Wild Goose Dreams. Of the 20 non-musical plays that are part of the Broadway season, three are directed by women. To Kill a Mockingbird is obviously a story about race and prejudice. It's directed by a white man. It's produced by a white man. It's written by a white man. It stars a white man. When you started thinking about who gets to tell stories, and in conjunction with that, who is going to see those stories, what strikes you about how far Broadway has come and how far it needs to go?
Well, Broadway will be the last domino. Just the numbers are such that nobody takes any chances. I mean, I shouldn't say that. That's not fair. There are a few people, a few savvy producers, and a few people who really believe in forwarding the art form take some chances, but it's a bad place to take chances. And whereas things have already begun to shift radically the further away from Broadway you go, so that off-Broadway productions are much more likely to be directed by people of color, by women, and to be about the lives of people of color and women and all other kinds of groups, and able to find success because they don't need to find 1,000 or 1,200 people willing to pay $150 a night to tell their stories.
Jesse Green is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times. Jesse, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, we talk with Nadine Lubicki, the director of Lebanon's entry for the foreign language Oscar, the movie Capernaum.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal says it's fresh from thunderous start to exquisite finish, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. For consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Like a lot of people, I don't often see films made in Lebanon, but there's one movie opening today, which is the country's official Oscar entry, that is required viewing. It's called Capernaum, and it's co-written and directed by Nadine Lubicki. When it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year, it got a 15-minute standing ovation. Capernaum follows the story of a resilient 12-year-old boy named Zane who sues his parents to stop them from having more children that they can't care for. When his barely adolescent sister is essentially sold to an older man, Zane runs away where he must survive on the streets. Nadine Lubicki spent years doing research into the lives of poor children, many of them refugees, living on the streets and in the slums of Beirut, and she cast non-professional actors in the film whose own lives mirror the story that Lubicki tells in Capernaum. But it all started one night when she saw a young boy living on the streets of Beirut trying to sleep.
I was thinking, if I was in the head of this child, what would he say to me? And so I don't know. I usually don't do this. I am not somebody who draws, or I don't have this kind of reflex. But I just drew the face of a child who is, you know, shouting, like he has his mouth wide open and he's shouting at adults. And it slowly with time, it became, you know, this child who was going to sue his parents for giving him life. So this, now I understand how this drawing slowly became that story.
When you think about how you're going to react to that, there are many different ways a filmmaker could react. One is to make a documentary, and one is to make a narrative film. So when you're thinking in your own mind about the advantages of a narrative film, what was the conversation you had with yourself, and how does a fictional story illuminate a truth that maybe a nonfiction film can't?
It started with a drawing and wanting to know more, you know, wanting to know how, what happened exactly in this child's mind. How did he look at us, this society that is neglecting him, mistreating him, abusing him? And so I started research. You know, it was a very, very long research. It took like 4 years. And the actual script writing was happening in parallel of this research. I went to a lot of prisons for minors, detention centers for minors, you know, courts, because I also wanted to understand how does the justice system work? How does it react to those kids when those kids are find themselves in front of justice because they need protection or because, you know, they committed a crime or what? And I spoke to a lot of kids. Most of the time, those kids would tell me, I would ask one question every time at the end of the conversation. Are you happy to be alive? And most of the times, unfortunately, the answer was no. I'm not happy to be alive. I wish I was dead. Some kids would say, I wish I was dead. They just are very angry. They used to tell me, why am I here? Why am I given life? Why do they give me life if they're not going to love me, if they're not going to feed me when I'm hungry, if I'm going to be tortured, if I'm going to be abused, raped, beaten up every day, if I'm going to, you know, never hear a nice word? And most of those kids even have a very harsh way of describing themselves. You know, they tell you, I'm an insect, I'm a parasite, I'm nothing, I'm trash. They don't even know when they are born. Most of them, 99% of those kids, when you ask them, so how old are you? He'd say, you know, I think I'm 10, I think I'm something like that. They never know their exact age. So you don't know your exact age, you don't know when you are born, what is your date of birth? They never know. So those kids never celebrated their birthday. There was never anyone that you know, blew a candle for them or that told them, you are important to me, I'm celebrating your birthday. I wanted to translate that anger. So at one point, of course, I was always not asking myself, but yes, is this going to be a narrative film, a fictional film, or is it going to be a documentary? Which form should this film take? And it was always a question. But it ended up having the form it has now. And it's a sort of, you know, semi-documentary in the sense that those kids are really, and everyone in the film, none of the people in the film are actors. Everyone is almost living, portraying their own story in life, their own struggle in life. So it's not really a documentary, but there's a documentary part to it.
We're talking with Nadine Labaki about her new film, Capernaum. When you cast not only non-professional actors, but children and some adults who are living the story that you are dramatizing, in some ways, they're probably going to reveal assumptions that you have about their lives that are incorrect. So in terms of your own education as a filmmaker, what were they telling you that challenged the way that you had seen them before and the stories and lives that you thought they had experienced?
I was very aware of that. I was aware that I didn't live this life. So Eventually, maybe I have misconceptions. Maybe there are things that I haven't been, you know, I haven't, I've had a normal childhood. I've never been hungry. I've never been deprived from my basic rights. I've never been deprived of school. I've never, you know, so for me, it was important that I didn't feel that I was sort of fantasizing this story. And you sometimes, unfortunately, it's only human that you judge. I was judgmental a lot of times. I used to enter, you know, those small, we can't really call them apartments, they're small rooms in those apartments. In each room there's a family, in those, you know, buildings that are, have become sort of the shelter for these families. I used to go into a room and see kids on their own, like 3 years old, 4 years old, cold, hungry, just left alone all day long. And the first reaction that you have is be angry at the mother. I used to be very angry, like, how can she do this? How can she leave them alone? These kids die every day from neglect, you know. I was always judgmental. How can she do this? How can she leave her kids? And I would wait for the mother. I would wait for her because I want to know, who is this mother? Who is she? And I want to tell her a piece of my mind. And I used to wait for her, and she would come, and we would sit down and start talking. And 10 minutes in the conversation, all my misconceptions would, you know, completely shift. And I was every time asking myself, how can I even give myself the right to judge her? I've never been in her shoes. I've never been hungry. My kids have never been hungry. I've never had to turn my back and leave because I have no other choice because I need to work. I've never had to sell my daughter, who's 11, 12, 13 years old, to a complete stranger, thinking that maybe it's going to be good for her. Maybe she's going to go eat. And maybe because I want to feed my other kids. I've never been in her shoes. I cannot judge. So we have to understand that, you know, they're all victims. The parents are as much of a victim as the kids. And they're all part of, this vicious circle that keeps excluding them and the system that cannot find solutions for them.
It's one thing to ask professional actors and professional actors who are adults to portray a scene that is very emotionally difficult. It's another thing to ask professional actors who might be children to depict that scene. It's something entirely different to have non-professional actors who are children portray scenes of families being torn apart. How do you create a place for your actors and for your film crew where the non-professional performers can do a scene like that, that feels incredibly true, where they also know that it's make-believe, even if it's so similar to the lives that they're living?
I think what really helped me in everything in this whole adventure, it was really the fact that they felt that they were part of a mission. I mean, Zane really knows what we're talking about in the film. It's not something that I am explaining to him. Most of the time, he would explain things to me. He would say, no, that's how it's done. A 12-year-old kid who's seen so much. So for him, it's that mission that he felt he was on that gave him the strength and us the same strength to keep doing what we were doing. And we all felt part of a mission. We all felt that we had to tell this story and we have to give it everything. Outside the shoot, outside the set, and outside the script, like I told you, they are invisible. So nobody listens to them. They feel like they use words like I told you, like we're parasites, we're trash. So when they are here and they feel important, they feel like they have something to say, they feel like there's a crew fascinated by their personality, by who they are part of the mission. So it gave them wings.
Nadine, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nadine Lubbocke's film Capernaum opens in limited release today. Coming up, Lindsay Buckingham breaks down the Fleetwood Mac song, Go Your Own Way. ¶¶ And now a new episode from Song Exploder. That's the podcast by our friend Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he sits down with musicians and has them deconstruct one of their songs. Today, it's singer, songwriter, guitarist, and producer Lindsey Buckingham. In 1974, he joined the band Fleetwood Mac, along with Stevie Nicks, his girlfriend at the time. A few years later, in 1977, Fleetwood Mac released the album Rumors, which would go on to sell more than 40 million copies and become the eighth highest-selling album in history. In this episode of Song Exploder, Buckingham breaks down Go Your Own Way, a song that he wrote for that album about his relationship with Stevie Nicks.
My name is Lindsey Buckingham. Stevie and I joined Fleetwood Mac in 74, and Go Your Own Way really was the beginning of my having a dialogue with Stevie, who had been my lover, and we were sort of on again, off again, on again, off again. But by the time we got to Rumors, she had sort of split, and Go Your Own Way was written almost as a stream of consciousness. I was just chunking away on those chords and coming up with the lyrics to go with it.
Loving you isn't the right thing to do.
If you start with the first lyric, loving you isn't the right thing to do, it sounds like you're beginning a conversation with someone. There was nothing about it that was thought out. It was just the raw expression of the emotion behind the song. I sort of was coming to terms with the fact that I may not be over this person, and at the same time, I'm aware that I've got to accept what's happened and move on.
How can I ever change things that I feel?
There was a song by the Rolling Stones that had a really great drum pattern that I thought would work over Go Your Own Way. The song is Street Fighting Man. It's going from the snare to the tongue. Boom, boom, boom.
Everywhere I hear the sound of Marvin George Speed, boy.
I said, Mick, I think this pattern going from snare to tom, not in the chorus, but in the verses, would be just great. But Mick is someone who he's playing strictly from the heart and from the gut. And as such, he just has to do what feels right to him. So when I showed him the pattern, he couldn't actually play it. And finally, I'm just saying to him, look, I mean, is there a way you can paraphrase that to make it your own? Which he does. He opens up the kick and keeps a 4-4 going on it. And instead of going from snare to tom, which felt wrong to him, he's playing the tom across the beat and letting the kick drum be the middle beat. I'm playing all the guitars. The objective was to try to get a few guitars to meld and sound like just one very extraordinary sounding guitar. There is something that's dirtier, and then there's something else which is going to be a little clean on its own, which might be a little anemic if you were only using that, but then you put them together.
You can go your own way. Go your own way. You can call it another lonely day.
There's a lot of oomph behind the lead vocal in Go Your Own Way because there was a lot of resolve behind the subject matter. I was feeling a lot of that subject matter as being something I was living. And so it was a bit cathartic to get that vocal out. It was a way of exercising certain hurts.
You can go your own way.
The backing vocals on Go Your Own Way are very straight ahead. Once the lead vocal had been done, you know, then the three of us worked out just a triad, and we worked that blend to our advantage almost every time.
You can call it another lonely day.
Cut to months later. I was back in L.A., and I was in my car. And there was a DJ in L.A. back then whose name was B. Mitchell Reed.
KFWB time on the B. Mitchell Reed Show, 4 after the hour.
I was listening to him in the car, and he says, "Hey, I've got the new Fleetwood Mac single for you now. I'm going to put that on right now." And he plays it, and I'm sitting there grooving to it in the car. Yeah, first time I've heard it on the radio. He comes back on, he goes, "That was the new Fleetwood Mac single." He takes a beat. He goes, "I don't know about that one." And I was able to call up the station in that moment after hearing that and be put through to B. Mitchell Reed while a song was on. And, you know, he got on the phone. I said, "Hey, B, this is Lindsey Buckingham here." "Oh, hi, Lindsey. You just played my song, Go Your Own Way, and you said you weren't sure about it. What didn't you like about it?" He's saying, "Well, you know, I couldn't find the beat." I went, "Oh, okay." I mean, that was an element to Go Your Own Way, but obviously it didn't make any difference in the long run. I was proud of what I was hearing on the radio, and that's all that mattered.
Lindsey Buckingham just released an anthology of his solo work. He is not part of the current Fleetwood Mac tour. And that's The Frame for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Brianna Flores. Our engineer is Valentina Rivera. And today, we say farewell to our fantastic intern, Maria Alexa Cavanaugh. She has done amazing work, and she has been a joy to work with. Good luck, Maria Alexa. And thanks to our friends at Argo Studios in New York for hosting me all this week. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday, and see you then.